Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine like stepping over a log on your favorite familiar hiking trail. You know every twisted root. You know exactly how the dirt feels under your boots.
Oh, absolutely. A trail you could probably walk blindfolded.
Right. But as your foot comes down, instead of seeing your own boot prints in the mud, you see the tracks of an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
In just a fraction of a second, the whole map of reality in your head just shatters. You aren't just in the quiet woods anymore. You have basically stumbled blindly into a magical proxy war.
It's the ultimate destabilizing moment, really. I mean, how do you ground yourself when the fundamental laws of your world are just rewritten overnight?
Exactly.
And, well, worse, what do you do when you realize the people hiking right next to you might actually be the ones pulling the strings?
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking a genuinely incredible narrative log today. It starts with just a simple hike and rapidly devolves into this masterclass on shifting
Yeah,
loyalties.
it gets so complicated so fast.
Oh, totally. It gets into the cold, hard mechanics of hidden magic and, the psychological whiplash of discovering your entire life is basically a lie.
Because this source material isn't just about the fantasy elements, right?
Yeah.
It is a profound look at human psychology.
Yeah, for sure.
When the ordinary rules of physics and of trust, honestly, are suspended, how do we cope? Do we panic or do we try to rewrite the rules ourselves?
Well, let's just jump right into the woods near a place called One Eyes Hill. So we're following a group of kids. There's Tom, Agatha, Simon, Alice, and Eleanor.
Pretty classic setup.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like a standard, maybe slightly boring afternoon exploration. Tom has his black cat, Shadow, just sort of draped over his shoulders.
As one does.
Right. But Shadow is actually the first one to realize the physics of the world are breaking. The cat's whiskers start twitching, his ears pin back, and he just hops down. He absolutely refuses to take another step forward.
Animals often serve as that early warning system in these narratives, you know? They
Right.
react to atmospheric or conceptual shifts way before human logic can process them.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Shadow isn't just being stubborn here. He is sensing a profound disruption in the local environment.
And the physical evidence is literally right there in the dirt. So they look down and find these bizarre, almost raccoon-like cat tracks.
Just such a weird visual.
Completely weird. But they aren't alone. These prints are overlapping with the tracks of creatures called the Drew.
Oh boy, the Drew.
Yeah, the kids have actually encountered the Drew before, and they describe them as these terrifying, unnatural entities. And now these nightmare tracks are leading them straight toward a dark cave with this weird dog-sized crack in its wall.
Notice the cognitive dissonance happening here, though. Their brains are desperately trying to rationalize what they are seeing.
Right, like trying to make it normal.
Exactly. Raccoon-like cat tracks is the human mind trying to map an impossible data point onto a known biological template.
Right, but they can't ignore it forever.
No, because the presence of the Druid tracks forces them to abandon logic completely. It acts as this breadcrumb trail, pulling them completely out of their safe rural town and straight to the threshold of the impossible.
So they actually follow the tracks. They cut southeast through this really dense, untrodden wilderness, and they spill out into a
Oh, a
clearing.
very specific kind of clearing.
Yes, in the center is a perfectly triangular pond, which we later find out is actually a portal referred to in the source as Siege. But nobody is even looking at the water.
Because of what's sitting next to it.
Exactly. Perched on a boulder right next to it is a creature they dub the Scarecrow. It is this dark, thorny, humanoid figure crouched like it's about to pounce, and it has this horrific, elongated nose, almost like a beak.
Just a chilling image.
Oh, totally. The youngest kid, Alice, physically shrinks away from it and mutters this incredibly creepy phrase. She says, "Buds hide flowers."
Shivers every time.
I know. But Tom, acting like the classic reckless explorer, actually wants to throw a rock at it. But Eleanor just completely panics and demands they retreat immediately.
What's fascinating here is that the scarecrow isn't necessarily a monster in the traditional predatory sense.
Wait, really? It looks like a monster.
It does, but the source material reveals it is an indiscriminate ward,
Yeah.
placed there by a magical faction known as House October. Its entire function is just to block access to that siege.
Okay, but if it's just a lock on a door, why the nightmare aesthetic? Like, why the thorns and the terrifying beak? I mean, a simple force field would do the trick, right? Think about a bouncer at an exclusive club. They're intimidating, sure, but they don't look inherently evil.
Well, because in a magical ecosystem, Terror is a highly efficient zero-energy security system.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Right. A physical wall can be climbed, a magical force field can be decoded or broken, but visceral biological fear, that hijacks the intruder's own nervous system and forces them to turn around.
That is so dark, but brilliant.
You don't need to spend energy physically repelling an intruder if their own adrenaline makes them run for their lives. It is psychological warfare masquerading as a physical barrier.
And it works perfectly. Running away strips that final illusion of a normal hike away from the group. Like, the danger is undeniable now.
The shift from curious kids to prey happens so fast.
So fast. And because the adrenaline is spiking, the pressure cooker of secrets finally just explodes. The second they are safe, Agatha cracks. She drops this geopolitical briefing masquerading as a confession.
And what a confession it is.
Right. She admits that just days prior, she actually traveled through a different portal, the Siege of Wind, into a completely different universe called Mirari.
And she didn't just wander around aimlessly. She was actively guided by an operative.
Yes. She went with an elf named Sir Tristan. And Tristan unloads this massive narrative on her. He claims that the faction we just mentioned, House October, has kidnapped the King of Mirari.
Which is a huge deal.
Huge. And because of how magic and time work in this world, stealing the king has triggered an eternal winter, a devastating period they call the year's end.
Right.
And Tristan gives Agatha one crucial piece of intelligence. He says House October uses crows as their minions, hence our thorny scarecrow friend, while Tristan's faction, House April, uses cats.
So suddenly, the weird raccoon cat tracks at the K's make perfect, terrifying sense.
Exactly. The pieces are coming together.
We really need to pause and unpack the political economy of Mirari that Agatha is describing, though.
Yeah, let's get into it.
If seasons in this world last for years, controlling a season isn't just about weather. It is about total economic and magical dominance.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, an eternal winter. The year's end means House October controls the resources, the food supply, and the magical flow of the entire realm. House April isn't just trying to rescue a political figurehead. They're trying to restart the planetary clock.
That makes the stakes just astronomical. But before Tom or, you know, the listener can even process Agatha's interplanetary espionage, Eleanor drops a counter-reveal that completely shanks the group's reality.
Oh, this part is wild.
Eleanor confesses that she isn't a normal teenage girl from their town. Her real name is Rachel Antoine. She is a full-blooded fairy, and she is an active agent for House October.
The psychological whiplash here is just staggering.
Just imagine being Tom right now. It's like having two friends giving you completely contradictory accounts of a messy breakup, but with magic.
That's a great way to put it.
How can Tom trust either of them when both have been lying by omission for so long? Eleanor completely contradicts Tristan's story. She insists House October did not kidnap the king.
Right. She flips the whole narrative.
Yeah. In fact, she claims House October desperately needs the kid's help to stabilize Mirari and stop House April from dragging the king back to his death.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the textbook definition of a proxy war. These ancient, immensely powerful magical houses are locked in a stalemate over the seasonal cycle. And for whatever reason, perhaps because mortals possess a unique type of agency, or maybe because human children aren't bound by the ancient fey packs, these factions are using Tom and his friends as pawns.
It's so manipulative.
It is. But the strategic implications pale in comparison to the psychological toll it takes on the kids.
Exactly. Betrayal from an enemy is expected. But Eleanor was part of their inner circle. She was hiding her true fey nature under the disguise of a timid, ordinary girl they completely trusted.
The sting of that is just brutal.
That kind of deception fundamentally breaks your ability to trust your own judgment. Like, how can Tom look at Eleanor and ever know what is real again?
And that crisis of trust doesn't just stay in their heads. The abstract lies they've been told suddenly become a physical, tangible reality right in front of them.
Yes, the conceptual deception manifests as physical deception. Here's where it gets really interesting. This brings us to the Danswick Ranch. It's this incredibly normal, rustic, dusty horse farm. The kids are trying to process the fact that they are basically drafted into a magical war. Eleanor is talking, and suddenly she trips backward, completely terrified by the sight of a normal-looking gray horse that is just happily eating sugar cubes out of Agatha's hand.
But Eleanor, being a fairy, isn't seeing the gray horse. Her biology interacts with the magic differently.
Right. She is seeing Suhait, This is Sir Tristan's massive, glowing white knight steed, like a magical war horse.
Which is just hiding right there in plain sight.
Yes, it's hiding behind a fairy glamour. And because the human kids have now been heavily exposed to fey magic, their own perception starts to glitch out. They experience this wild double vision effect.
It's such a cool concept.
They are simultaneously seeing the small, dusty gray gelding and the giant, glowing white charger occupying the exact same physical space. Little Alice even reaches up and pets the invisible muzzle of this giant horse.
It is a brilliant physical manifestation of their shattered reality.
Mm-hmm.
They are quite literally inhabiting two conflicting worlds at the exact same moment.
The best way to visualize this is to imagine you are wearing a pair of highly advanced augmented reality glasses, right?
Okay, yeah.
You're looking around your normal living room, but through the lenses, there is a giant breathing digital dragon just sitting on your sofa. If you take the glasses off, it's just your sofa. Put them back on, dragon.
That's a perfect analogy.
The kids are experiencing that, but without the glasses. Their biological hardware is receiving two completely different signal streams.
And they even discuss trying to find a workaround for this, right?
Yeah, they talk about finding an item called Rebecca's Opticon, which is this magical camera that supposedly captures the objective truth through any disguise.
The mechanics of the Opticon and the glamour are really fascinating to break down. In the physics of this world, there is a distinct difference between a glamour and true shapeshifting.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, so a glamour, like what the Night Steed is using, is a localized visual trick. It doesn't change the horse's mass or molecular structure. It just alters how the light and cognitive perception interact around it.
Okay, makes sense.
That is why a mechanical device like the Opticon camera could pierce it. The camera doesn't have a biological brain to fool. It just records objective photons.
But wait. Earlier in the source material, Tom encounters a cross-eyed cat named Bragwaine who physically turns into a girl. So that's different.
Completely different. That is true shapeshifting. That actually alters the physical reality and mass of the subject.
Oh, wow.
A camera wouldn't see through that because the physical truth has been rewritten. It forces you to constantly evaluate what type of deception you are actually dealing with.
Right. Like, is someone projecting a false image or have they fundamentally changed their nature?
Exactly. How much of what you see is objective truth and how much is a subjective projection designed to manipulate you?
And Tom is acutely aware that he's being manipulated. His senses are glitching. His best friend is a fairy spy. And there are magical war beasts hiding at the local petting zoo.
His agency has just been completely stripped away.
Completely. So what does a kid do when the fundamental rules of reality are suddenly out of his hands? He actively rebels against the magic by embracing the most rigid, unyielding laws of human physics.
This raises an important question about how we cope with trauma. It is a fascinating psychological defense mechanism. When conceptual magic breaks your brain, you crave the unbreakable laws of mechanics.
Fast forward a week, and Tom has retreated to the woods with his dad to build this massive fortress called the Gnarly Tree Fort.
He goes all out.
He really does. He isn't just nailing a few planks to a branch. He has engineered a highly complex, hand-cranked pulley elevator out of salvaged parts using heavy winches and thick rope.
A proper engineering project.
Yeah, and when Simon comes to visit, they test it. They crank themselves way up into the canopy. But on the way down, Tom intentionally lets go of the winch to test the free fall.
Which is terrifying.
The cage plummets the last few feet and hits the ground with a massive bone-rattling ka-thump.
That ka-thump is the sound of gravity. It is reliable, it is predictable, and it cannot be bargained with or glamored.
Right. It's real.
Tom needed to feel the physical sensation of falling to remind himself that the earth still pulls downward. The treehouse is a physical coping mechanism for a world spinning out of control. It is an assertion of human reality over fairy subjectivity.
And he is heavily leaning into that human assertion. Up in that treehouse, he confesses to Simon that he still doesn't trust Eleanor or Agatha.
Which is fair, honestly.
Totally fair. He is actively planning to sneak back into House October's cave, the one guarded by the Scarecrow, and he wants to use cherry bombs to blow up the tunnel and seal it off.
So human.
Right. He's literally trying to use gunpowder to solve a magical dispute. Isn't Tom's plan to sneak back into the cave with Simon just a desperate attempt to regain control? It's like trying to hack the servers of a video game you just realized you're trapped inside.
Which really highlights his desperation. He is trying to force his will onto a situation that terrifies him. As you pointed out, instead of playing by the game's rules, he tries to physically smash the servers. The treehouse, the pulleys, the cherry bombs, these are all mechanical coping mechanisms.
Mm.
He is trying to assert Newtonian physics to barricade himself against fey magic.
But up in that tree, Tom also reveals that he is thinking much bigger than just cherry bombs. He drops a completely radical theory about their own identities.
This is where it gets so good.
He points out a pattern. She, Agatha, and Rebecca all have incredibly bright green eyes. Alice has strikingly fair blonde hair and blue eyes. In folklore, these are the classic, undeniable phenotypic symbols of the Fae.
The signs were there all along.
Yeah. Tom suspects that the reason they can access these hidden sieges, and the reason both House October and House April are so intensely focused on them, isn't because they are randomly lucky. It is because the kids themselves actually have Fae ancestry.
This is where Tom transitions from reacting to strategizing. By theorizing about their Fae ancestry, he is looking for a bridge between human physics and fairy magic.
He's trying to hack the system from the inside.
Exactly. He is searching for the source code of his own identity. If they are purely mortal kids, they are just collateral damage in this proxy war.
Right, just pawns.
But if they carry fey blood, they are suddenly stakeholders. They aren't just hapless pawns being pushed around the board by Sir Tristan and Rachel Antoine. They belong to this magical ecosystem.
That completely shifts the dynamic.
It does. They have a rightful place in the hierarchy. Tom's Fae ancestry theory is a brilliant, desperate attempt to reclaim agency in a rigged game.
And what an incredibly dangerous game they are playing. We started this journey looking at a few confusing tracks in the mud, and we have peeled back the layers to reveal a sprawling, ruthless political proxy war.
It's quite the escalation.
It really is. We've explored magical courts battling to control the very concept of time and seasons, massive glowing warhorses hiding behind localized illusions, and secret fairy identities embedded in teenage friend groups.
Just a lot to handle for a bunch of kids.
Oh, absolutely. And in the center of it all, you have a kid building a mechanical elevator in a tree just to remind himself that gravity still exists.
It perfectly illustrates how thin the veil is between the ordinary and the extraordinary, and how chaotic the truth becomes once that veil is finally torn away.
So what does this all mean for you? Even if you never stumble across a portal or a shape-shifting cat, we all face moments where the map of our reality changes unexpectedly.
Yeah. That's a really universal experience.
We've all had to navigate relationships where we suddenly realize someone has a glamour covering their true intentions, right? Projecting an image to manipulate the situation. When the ground drops out from under you, do you retreat to your treehouse and cling to the rules you know? Or do you start looking for your own version of the Opticon, searching for the objective truth, no matter how terrifying the scarecrow guarding it might be?
And as you think about how you would react, consider this final unsettling implication hidden in the source material.
Ooh, what's that?
We know House October and House April are engaged in a centuries-old war over the missing king, and these kids are somehow prophesied to break the cycle of Moriarty's seasons.
Right.
But if Tom's theory is right, if these kids truly have Fae ancestry combined with unpredictable human agency, and they possess the raw power to fundamentally alter the reality of this magical world, what if the kids themselves are the actual existential threat?
Wait, really?
Yeah. What if these ancient houses aren't just trying to use them as pawns, but are actually desperately trying to contain them before these human-fae hybrids tear the entire magical system apart?
Oh, wow. That completely inverts the power dynamic. They aren't the prey. They are the bomb waiting to go off. That is incredibly compelling. Well, thank you for joining us as we explored these sources today. The next time you are hiking your favorite familiar trail, pay close attention to the footprints in the mud. You never know when the rules of your reality are about to completely change. Catch you next time.